You're listening to WCOM LP Chapel Hill, Carrboro. Freedom of expression is essential to a free society, and that's what we're all about here at Claudio Speakeasy. Welcome, everybody. We're bringing Carolina coast to coast and the speakeasy to your doorstep. Your host, Claudio, Renaissance man and bard of WCOM, has opened the doors of the speakeasy to invite you all to come as you are on this Tuesday morning.
Indeed.
Relaxed in your PJs if you like, or we're not even going to ask.
Come naked if you dare.
Find a seat, get comfortable in the place where you're always welcome and can always expect the very best. Good morning.
Good morning. You could have kept that music playing. I was getting ready to put out a hammock and just swing in the breeze.
Sitting here kind of rocking
this
around.
This is the speakeasy, and I'm wondering where the hooch is. Isn't it supposed to be some
hooch?
The hooch, yeah. This is supposed to be some hooch here.
Somebody go ahead and deliver some. Yeah, I know, you're right.
Right. We've got a big sign up here. There.
It's missing.
No alcohol.
No alcohol. Illegal drugs.
I guess we're going to have to do
that. We have to wait until we leave the place.
Right. Well, we're going to go over to the Bottle Wings.
We got the Hoochie Coochie reputation anyway, so it's okay.
And get their dollar beers.
In case you're wondering why you're hearing that voice on Tuesday, that's Paul Nash, who's commonly with Audrey on Carolina Bookbeat. So we've got him here today because he just got back from San Francisco. I was actually going to open the show with Tony Bennett singing I Left My Heart in That Place, but couldn't find it, so we went with that, but we've got Paul Nash is going to give us a little window into San Francisco. Right.
I left my heart.
Yes, he just did.
In San Francisco.
So I want to quickly...
left my voice there, too.
Yes, indeed. And by the way, it's Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater.
Did I not say that?
Yeah, there we go. Of course, we've got to do more to show the theatrical on the show. Normally, I consider the whole show spontaneous theater, but we are actually going to start installing on a regular basis a theatrical element of literature and so on, at least 20 minutes with every show coming up. So you can hold us to that in the
near
future.
That will be really fascinating, and I hope that I'm one of the characters.
You are definitely going to be one of
the
characters. Definitely.
That's what I'm looking forward to. Yeah.
You be the guy.
Turn that mic to you. That's beautiful.
We're going to call you Hooch. Come and join us.
We could each adopt a particular persona.
Oh, we can adopt two or three.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
This way we can avoid a shrink.
That's right. Yes, and our voices will be our costumes.
That's right.
Exactly.
And I can pretend I know another accent.
Exactly.
Which I don't, so that's
and there's
be
a train you just missed.
Have
you got the ticket?
Yes, that's me whistling.
That's him and his bass whistling.
Maybe I'll try to put up my southern accent.
Go ahead. You can do that. You can wax as poetic as you want with that one. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Quick shout out to the Carolina Theater of Durham. They're still undergoing renovations, but ready to open on October 1st, so check out what's happening there. And as
Carolina
far as
Theater, www.carolinatheater.org.
There we go. And am I
just
is there anything important we're supposed to say right now before we go to Paul? I can't remember. My head's sort of empty this morning. I haven't been here in a few shows, folks.
No.
Sorry about that. Last time it was a tornado watch that kept me at home last week.
Right. And that tornado or watch was... It followed the exact route you would have to drive to get from
exactly,
Broadway
oddly enough.
To Carrboro. It was just saying... No, Claudio, stay home.
Yes, indeed. You leave and you'll come back to no home.
Or you'll fly away.
Yes. That's usually in a Oklahoma
either,
direction.
Either that or you've got a really clean
or
car.
Or Kansas. Yeah, right. So give us the scoop or the hooch on San Francisco. What took you there?
Well, what took me there was family business. And besides family, which I'm a native San Franciscan.
Yes.
As I like to tell everybody, I was living in the Haight-Ashbury before people knew it as a Haight-Ashbury. In fact, I was a part of a little street gang made out of African-American kids and Russian-American kids and me.
I had the same thing going in Africa.
Yeah. And we used to run around and, try to shake down the people to make a little pocket change. Mm-hmm. Didn't work very well. We've discovered that hippies don't have any money. Really? No. It's no fun, so, you know?
So you were a hippie with a limp and a hat? Is that the idea?
You know, I was a little thug, you know, preying on hippies. I never quite identified with hippies, but that was so long ago that I can't remember it anymore.
So the occasion to San Francisco this time was you went to see your mother,
and
of course you went to a tarot convention, right?
Yes. There's a they had their 20th anniversary of a continuous, the longest as far as we know, continuous annual tarot convention in the world. 20 years it celebrated this last 2 weeks ago. And it is known as the Bay Area's Tarot Symposium, affectionately known as BATS.
BATS. BATS in your belfry.
Yes, and it's put on by Daughters of Divination and Thalassa Therese.
D.O.D.?
Yes, I do remember.
Yes, D.O.D. Yes, so we're definitely dead on arrival. And Thalassa Therese is a well-known tarot reader and a stand-up performer. And she and I are always in competition because what I used to do in San Francisco before I left there about 15 years ago was I did stand-up performance. So we're always in competition.
What sort of performance?
Stand-up performances, it wasn't what attempted to be comedy. It was based on story.
Uh-huh.
And it was, you know, you'd stand up and basically tell an engaging, elaborate story. The one that I worked on
like
most
a monologue,
did. Yeah, the one I did most had the title of Love, Lust, and Hallucinations.
Mm-hmm.
And it was based on, you know, a little infatuation I had when I was in my 30s, which was so long ago, I don't remember then.
Breaking a bad package of that.
Yeah, exactly. And what I discovered about stand-up performance is that telling that story, when I give myself about 30 minutes to tell it, telling that story was so exhausting, so emotionally wrenching, so incredibly tearing apart the fabric of reality for me, that I really found that a little difficult to do.
Uh-huh.
Twice a night.
What's happened since then?
Well, let's put it this way. If I feel the twinges of infatuation upon me, I take 3 aspirin and go to bed.
And the person learns.
And I refuse ever to see that person again. That
see what performing can do to you?
Might be inkling it out of me. Oh, no, you got the hicks on me. No way. Stay away from me.
So let's divert for a moment, because I'm kind of curious as to what Frisco is these days. Give us a little window on San Francisco itself.
Well, you have to remember that I see it as a native, which means that for me, the true San Francisco is the San Francisco of Rear Window, from Jimmy Stewart running around.
Alfred Hitchcock,
you know. That's the true skyline of San Francisco, which means the abomination that is now upon the map is with all those ridiculously large buildings
overly developed,
completely obliterated the possibility of recognizing there's a hill in the place, except if you happen to be crawling around on the hills.
But
well,
what
you know
about
it.
Maupin's Tales of the City? I mean, is that true San Francisco?
Well, that's true San Francisco if you came of age in late 1970.
Well, explain what that is to anyone that might not know.
Okay, there's a series of novels, and I believe it's Augustus Maupin or whatever his first name is. They actually had a series on PBS
in the
for
newspaper.
A while.
It was in the newspaper.
And you can get the books. It's a collection of maybe 6 or 7
it
books.
It was actually a serial that was run, I think, in the Examiner or the Chronicle.
Well, they are in book form, and I recommend them. They're good.
But you're basically saying it's no longer the Bohemia it once was.
Oh, it's definitely the Bohemia it was once if you're 20.
Yeah, right.
So it's not the city that's changed, it's the person.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
I can see that, but you were talking about it being...
I have a friend of mine who's lived all of his life in North Beach and is definitely a bohemian, and I will not otherwise characterize him. And he recently moved back to San Francisco where he had maintained a hotel flop, you know, which is where he lives now, and the... And as he said, you know, he said, all the people that used to be sort of on the edge and hanging around, he says, they're all gone. They just can't hang out in the city anymore because there ain't no place for them.
Hmm.
You know, the people that were really on, and he says, and the other people that are there, but they're all, everybody's older. This is Cafe Trieste is the... is the center, you know, ground.
What about the physical structure of the place itself? It's gotten really built up, is that what you're saying?
Yes, it is built up, and it's also shifted to south of Market, which is kind of strange.
Hmm.
But also kind of a full circle. The original hotsy-totsy neighborhood in San Francisco was, which most people don't know, was a little neighborhood. His name I'm not going to remember, but it was south of Market Street. And then... what happened is that, you know, the gold rush hit and so forth and so on. And everything moved over to the downtown area and also where the wharves were.
Mm-hmm.
And then every now and then the city would burn down and then they would come in and cover all of everything and then it would go down. And so, for instance, when they built the famous Transamerica Pyramid building that everybody likes to stand in awe of, there and is, you know, as far as buildings go, it's not a bad way to.
It's actually built like a pyramid?
Yeah, well, it's built like a needle more than a pyramid. So it's really a skyscraper. Right. But when they dug it up, they found underneath it there were several wrecks. And, you know, they found, you know, volumes of completely undrinkable. Champagne and stuff that had been in the fires in the 1850s, but that's
so you could have brought some of that hooch.
Yeah, it would have been something else. Actually, I think they did auction them off. And one of the things I did before I left San Francisco was I was a tour director, and I did develop tours of the city, including at that time south of Market tour. Which at that time was a great nightlife area and still is. It's a nightlife area which developed originally around the gay lifestyle and then also comedy clubs. And then later, during there was also where a lot of S&M dungeons were nicely inhabited in various places. So I knew about these things. Don't ask me why. And that's another story.
Why?
Yeah.
From fetishes to clean socks, okay.
Yes, well, nice, because I used to be a social scientist. and I used to hang, and I had a two-year contract to study S&M, consensual S&M lifestyles. So I went in and just hung out with the people for 2 years.
If you haven't had breakfast yet, folks, we apologize.
Yes, exactly. Well, we won't talk about what consensual S&M lifestyles are like. They're probably more chaotic than the middle class wants to imagine.
Yes.
but in other ways, remarkably stable, at least in the short term. You know, two, three, four years, it's always seemed relatively stable. 2 years immersion. Then I went off to seminary, and let me talk about culture shock.
But you bounced around.
Yeah, right.
So where's God in all this? Yeah.
Yeah, well, we found God. We discovered that, you know, for some people, God needs a full range of the dial, as we might say. Needs to be really loud and really soft. And other people sort of want God to come in at the same level that they talk, you know. God, I want your still small voice to be loud enough so I can hear it.
Come through all my stupefactions, please. Yes.
Yes. I know I'm so busy talking to you, I don't bother to listen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what happened is in this and so San Francisco is a great place, like Boston in a way, a great place for young people who are just starting out. And for wealthy people, and everybody else gets
expensive. Yeah.
Yeah, everybody else get out of town because there ain't no room for no families, and this the base of the family base is shrinking, and the other thing is that's shrinking is what we call the Anglo base, the white people base is shrinking. It's now definitely close to almost 60%. Asian.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
And I have no, you know, and so that you really can say that San Francisco is, you know, Shanghai by the Bay. And, you know, and it's, you know, and, you know, Chinatown has, you know, completely, you know, mushroomed out into all parts of the Sunset and everywhere else. And if there's real estate available, it's bought up by Asians.
Interesting.
And you know, the, when Hong Kong money was available, when it was the, 20 years ago,
the yen
it was
money?
Coming in. Yeah, it was really coming in and built up strong. And that was not only in San Francisco and the environs, but also the other port cities of Seattle and Portland to a degree, though not as outrageously much as in San Francisco.
I think San Francisco is sort of assumed at this point to be the gay capital of the U.S. Is that, does that hold any truth?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. According to my family members who inhabit that niche. They are quite happy living in the gay capital of the world. Mm-hmm. And, yes, it is. It's the only place where you can walk down the street and with your arm around your sweetheart, this lovely young woman, and other people look at you like, boy, that's strange.
Yes, what's your name?
You know, and you feel yourself that you is. So why is it I only see women hugging women and men hugging men?
I mean,
really, that we must be, you know, interspecies, you know. So there seems to be something wrong. Are we doing something, you know, that's bestial somehow?
Don't know. Well, take us from that note back to the seminary there for a second. You had my curiosity piqued. You and I have talked about this before, but just curious about your experience in the seminary.
Oh, well, you know, as I said, I went from this lifestyle of consensual S&M
study. Then you felt you had to confess your sins.
No, I knew it just took a while to get to the seminary. So they actually liked me there because I had spent years working in you know, distressed neighborhoods with distressed populations, the homeless, children that were at risk and stuff like that. So, you know, they thought I was a good, you know, urban minister type, you know, who, you know, deserved, you know, a little theological education so I could continue to work with the poor and not mind that I'm poor myself in the process. You know, sort of like gets to know, like, you want to be wealthy, hang out with wealthy people. You want to be poor, hang out with poor people. You know, real simple. You want
Is that
to be
how it
middle
works?
Class?
Yeah. I'm just sort of stuck in the middle somewhere.
You know, and the nice thing about it, when you just know poor people, you don't have to worry about ever getting rich. Of course, they probably won't just starve either. You know, whereas if you are hanging out with rich people and you're poor, they may let you starve because they haven't really thought of it any difference. You know?
Yeah, not the same compassion, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, they just don't think of it in that terms. It just doesn't ever dawn on them that anybody,
that
could
anybody would possibly starve.
Yeah.
No, it seems it's not in their world.
Yeah, it's not in their world, you know, or that things could be simply so dire.
Mm-hmm.
But the...
after all, we do have the dumpsters.
Well, yeah.
Had to throw that in.
Yes, yes. And, of course, in there, I have a couple of good friends who live well in San Francisco, now on their real estate holdings. Got it all through dumpster diving.
I know quite a few folks. My dentist, I went to not long ago, we were having a conversation while he was working on one of my teeth, and he was telling me how much he missed dumpster diving. And in some of those wealthy areas.
Some of the very
areas,
best people go dumpster diving.
And I say, and you must have said, well,
I've
gee whiz, look at, oh, yeah, I guess I, every time that you look at the sewer of my mouth, you must be reminded of a dumpster, right? Yeah, yeah. You know, when you see those broken whatever they are, you know, yeah, I'm sure I can pull a tricycle out of here somewhere.
All right.
Anyway, yes, so you were
We don't
in
have
seminary.
The hooch, but we do have the metaphor.
Yeah, so the... So the seminary then for me was I didn't know it at the time, but it was basically a respite. It was a way of sort of regathering.
How long were you there?
She wasn't there. Well, a normal MDiv program is about 2.5-3 years.
Mm-hmm.
A year of it is done as a 2 years of study and 1 year is internship. And so I spent a year in Oklahoma City. Pre-bombing of Oklahoma City. In fact, I used to park my car right in front of where the bomb went off and walk across the street to the YMCA and go work out. those days I was much more optimistic about trying to, you know, keep the...
Stay in shape.
About exercise, you know. Mm-hmm. Somehow I thought maybe exercise would keep me alive an extra week or two.
He wasn't giving himself much time there, was he?
Yeah.
Extra week or two.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Not the general idea.
But actually, see, this is what people don't understand, is that death is written in your genes. They aren't in your behaviors. I mean, you can add a few years through your behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Or detract some.
Detract a few. But basically, it's in your genes. And I do recommend Levi's because they were invented in San Francisco. And
you want me to wear gay jeans?
San Francisco. Yeah.
So you did get your master's in divinity.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, I have a master's of divinity, and I used to say, yes, I'm a master of divinity. That means I tell God what to do all the time. And unfortunately, God just isn't listening, you know. I tell you, this world would be such a wonderful place if God just listened.
And here come the thunderbolts.
That's right.
Yes. Listen, God, listen.
And you're listening to Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater here on WCOM 103.5 FM. I've got my lovely co-host, Audrey Layden, here next to me on one side, on my right, and to my left, the wonderful, mystical fellow here that you're hearing the rantings of, Paul Nash.
Yeah,
so and you may continue to rant.
Oh, yes, all right. So return to getting God to listen, I will tell you about BATS, which is the Bay Area Tarot Symposium.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I have to confess that I'm so shy and withdrawing of nature and don't like to address talk to strangers, that I have discovered the perfect beard, which is a camera. And so what I do is I take my camera out and I say, let me take you a picture, and I stick my camera in their face and click the camera thing. Now, normally what I should do afterwards is I should then talk to these people and find out who the heck they were. But I usually don't. You know, I want to go on and take somebody else's.
It's a new world.
You know, and so I'm just taking people's pictures. And so I do this at these conventions, and people say they like the photographs, and you know, so I'm happy with it.
They're all up on Facebook, or a big bunch of them are.
Yeah, they're
up on
Facebook. Right? Yeah,
you gotta look that up.
Paul Nash, Paul Nash Tarot. You'll forget me for sure. There's not that many Paul Nashes on Facebook, Nagy, and you'd and then go to my albums, and you would see
You'll see the bats.
You'll see the bats. Lots of. You'll see a couple of years of bats up there, but they're numbered by year. I guess I got last year's and this year's, and the and also another one. If you're really interested in seeing photographs of completely esoteric tarot readers from around the world, because that's whom they mostly are. Our tarot readers, tarot deck creators, and so forth.
And people who create their own decks and write books about
them. And write the books about the tarot. These are endless photographs. And some of them are actually labeled, so you can see various photos of Mary Kay Greer, who is definitely one of the great tarot commentators. And actually, she has a new book coming out. It's actually not a new book. It's her second famous book. Her first book is called Tarot for Yourself, and it was a workbook on how to get to know what a tarot deck was like, and also how to read the cards for yourself. Now, in olden days, before 1960 or 1970 or 1980, the olden days.
You slow down now.
Feeling older and older and older the more he talks.
Got me feeling like Gandhi here.
Yeah, right. The olden days, you don't supposed to read tarot for yourself, you know, because that's a form of, actually drives you crazy. I just keep turning all these cards over and I keep getting this no-named car, you know, whether it got a... You know, got a skull with a mask on, you know, with a sickle, chopping heads off there. And I don't know what that means.
I have to stay home and crawl under the bed and stay there.
Yeah, right. You know, I keep getting that over and over again. You know, what does that mean? And of course, you know, well, that just means that you're in for some serious change.
Oh, man.
Or some of your friends ain't going to last very long.
Some Jamaican friends are coming over and things are going to change.
Make new friends. Make new friends.
Yeah. You're going to need to make new friends soon because your pool of available resources is going to diminish.
That cloud you keep seeing is a puff of smoke. Yes.
Yeah. So what happens is... So Mary came out with her second book. I don't remember what the actual title was for. Has now been redone and rewritten thoroughly, and it is on what's called birth cards in tarot. Basically, it's an array of two cards each. In some cases, three of major arcana, which means they only deal with the 22, what are known as the trumps in tarot. And those are the funny-looking cards that are not in a regular pack of playing cards. And the and it's called Who Are You in Tarot? And it basically deals with these nine personality characterizations. You could sort of say it's sort of an enneagram of Tarot. And she didn't invent this, but she did develop it in a way that more thoroughly than anyone else did before her. Another place that has subsequently developed it, following a slightly different system than hers, was the Tarot School. And the Tarot School is in New York City, and it's run by the Amberstones. And the Amberstones and Mary Greer know each other quite well. So when she did this version, she integrated their insights into the birth cards. So it's a slightly divergent, but also, at this point, synthetic view of how to understand sort of like personality configuration that would be sort of the equivalent of a horoscope. Mm-hmm. For instance, I'm
a
train.
It's time for me to leave. See you guys.
I'm a train, yeah. And in the, yes, in the tarots, I'm I'm a magician, and a magician is the first card, and I'm also a wheel, which is the 10th card, and I am also, I'm not thinking straight.
He's not quite himself today, folks.
So the wheel is that the Wheel of Fortune?
Yes, the Wheel of Fortune, and then also the... last one is, I have to look it up, I'm sorry, I should know these things off the top of my head.
You should
head,
know
but
who you
busy.
Are, Paul. Who are you?
I'm the Wheel of Fortune, I'm also the Sun card,
uh-huh.
Which is, what number is the Sun card? I mean, I'm a world-class tarot reader, and I'm not making any associations.
You got him gunshot in front of the microphone, which is unusual
because he's
in front of a mic on another show.
Yeah.
Well, that's right. That's quite a good combination, I would say.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of some wheel magicians that are tarot readers.
Uh-huh.
One of our local professional tarot readers here in the Beth Owl's daughter is a sun wheel magician.
When you had your own show, you did quite a bit on tarot. I remember that.
Yeah, talk about it now and again. And actually, there was someone who did, I think, an astrology show here way back when it got started. And I thought of doing a tarot show. But I probably wouldn't get enough call-ins to be doing regular readings for people, so I'd have to be, come up with little how to do tarot shows. Actually, in the blogosphere, there are several... very good blog shows now that have broadcasts on how to read tarot, all of which are about 2 hours long and deal at great length and in great depth with various aspects of the tarot and how to read it and how to understand the symbolism of it and stuff.
So I was going to ask you, what is it that you do besides tarot? I mean, what are you doing outside of that? I want to say you did something in publishing at one time. Are you still reviewing books?
I mean, the way I actually make a living, if I try to just make a living as a tarot reader, I would be out there with the homeless like everybody else begging, except I would, you know, instead of, you know, asking you for, would you like your cards read? Because around here, most people give me the hex sign and walk away.
So you're still
that. So I still review books, and you know, the more obscure, the happier I am,
and the bigger,
and the bigger I am. It's like that, like the book I was looking at last night that I enjoyed so much, called The Satanic Epic. No, it's not about tarot, friends. It's about Milton.
Satanic or satanic?
Yes, satanic. Satanic epic. Yes, I call it Satanic Epic because it's like a drought of long symbolism.
So what's that old fellow up to these days?
Yes, and that's on Milton and the Milton's Paradise Lost, mm-hmm. and how that, you know, has this profound world depth. And so it goes into the depth of the associations of Milton's understanding of sin and human failing, and
this is how you amuse yourself.
Interesting.
That's just light reading. I was 3 a.m. I was reaching up, you know, stretching to grab my one volume edition of Milton's work and pull it down, you know.
And you did a review on this?
No, I was just reading.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Just reading. This was for fun. Yeah.
I see. Yes, yes.
Sin and death and loss and destruction. Yes. Yeah, what fun.
Yeah. Who needs to sleep? I can read this all night long.
Let's see
I
what the perfects are doing today.
Anymore.
Yes.
Milton Paradise Lost. I mean, I really deserve, you know, in some ways, and I probably someone has. That should be dramatized. I mean, it really should be dramatized.
Has it ever been tried to in film? I don't think so.
I mean, well, one thing, the language is so it's Milton, like, you know, Shakespeare caught the language at its crystalline when it just started to formulate. It was mm-hmm. still incredibly concrete. And all the metaphors were fresh and falling from the sky like rain. And Milton came along, about 200 years later. And
said, here's your umbrella.
And then, he brought up all of the incredible abstraction of English. I mean, in some ways, Shakespeare is the language as sensate, and Milton is the language as reaching towards transcendence. But also, as it were, wallowing in imminence, and wallowing in the world as a cesspool of what we could have made it, but we didn't. Doesn't this sort of sound like an environmental catastrophe?
It kind of sounds like what's going on in Washington.
Yeah, yeah, well, obviously. And it just shows you that it goes on all the time. And Milton did live through the Glorious Revolution, which was the revolution that England had in the 1650s, let's say, that actually prevented them from having the catastrophe of the French Revolution, which was when, you know, they resisted for a whole, those wily French were able to resist serious social change for a whole century, and they thought they had done a good job, and all they really had done is made the powder keg even worse, so it really popped, began a serious thing. And of course, the American Revolution was basically how the Glorious Revolution failed. And the Glorious Revolution was essentially the Puritan Revolution. It was Cromwell throwing out the king, taking over Republic, it wallowing around for about 40 years of incompetency, and then calling back a king who happened to be Catholic, and that didn't go well with people who wanted to maintain the throne. They're never really happy with a Catholic king when you're still, you know, tweeting your nose at the Pope.
And now for something a little more lighthearted, Audrey's going to take us into Dante's Inferno.
Yes, right. And well, there, you know, well, One of the things that now we actually are supposedly talking about the Bay Area Tarot Symposium, known as BATS. And I do like this BATS a great deal, and I do enjoy it. And one of the people I enjoy there wonderfully, and she actually has a blog. Well, I haven't been on it recently. Her name is Carol Pierce. That's P-I-E-R-C-E, I believe. And she is a literary historian who actually does, or one of her specialties is tarot references in literary works. And she comes each year in her nice sort of, I won't say schoolmarm way, though actually I'm very fond of this brilliant woman. And I have a sort of crush on her, but I try to keep these things
you
to
heard
myself.
It here first.
Yes. Just take your aspirin.
Yes, yeah, that's right. antidote. Yes, but she and she discussed this year. She's discussed Yeats in previous years and other things, but this year she discussed the Arcanum 17 by André Breton, the great surrealist. And Arcanum 17 is the star, major arcana card, and it's his interpretation of the star from the André Wirth deck. The André Wirth deck is going to be featured in the next Sherlock Holmes movie, and there are only two original André Wirth major arcana only decks in existence in the world, and one of them is actually going to be seen filmically in this new Sherlock Holmes
word.
Film.
Filmically! Cinematography.
Oh, well, what do I know? You know,
hey,
you
know.
It works. It works.
You know, after
Shakespeare's, and then raining metaphors.
Milton got to him.
Yes.
You can throw in a film.
Well, yes. I mean, you know. I read Milton originally when I was about 14, and I have to admit that I read him. And I found the language intriguing. It's rich.
I'm going to have to look him up for that very reason.
But I also discovered that I didn't understand the word that he had to say, and still don't too well. And in some ways, I would like to
That used to amaze me at pubs. We had this, to divert for a moment, we had this Englishman that would occasionally take a job on the yacht whenever we were cleaning and painting and, you know, refurbishing the boat. And he had a Cockney accent that was so bad that you could barely make out what he was saying most of the time. So most of the time, I just let him talk and didn't even try to listen. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing was at the pub at night afterwards, when we go after the first two beers, I understood him fine. I have no idea what altered.
Was it two beers? You had the two beers.
Me,
or he
me,
had the
me.
Two beers.
He had more.
Or maybe it was a combination of the two.
Yeah. Well, after the third beer, you don't listen at all, right? You don't remember anything, yeah.
And after the fifth or sixth, everything at the closing time, you take those aspirins.
Yeah, right. And what I used to do when I would drink myself into near oblivion is I always said, okay, so as soon as I'm going to drink a quart of water, and of course that would mean that I'd have to immediately...
lose the liquids in your body.
Yes,
because because you know, before I passed out, I had to do something, otherwise I would be waking up with an incredibly painful bladder. But the one of the things, but it did was wonderful. I never had a headache afterwards. That's always great, because most of the drunk headaches have to do with the dehydration.
Yeah, that's true.
Your brain is. You know, squeezing.
You know, back to the inferno.
Like a sponge, yeah. The back to BATS. So she discussed...
we're burning BATS now.
Okay. Yes, right. Back to BATS, the Bay Area Tarot Symposium. She, Carol Pierce, did this wonderful discussion of selecting a few passages from this rather sort of novelette that Breton wrote on the hope, on the... Arcanum on the star, and she, you know, picked out a few of his things, particularly that were descriptive of the card that he was using, which is from the Wirth deck. You may see it. I don't know which cards they're going to use in the Sherlock Holmes one, but it might show up. It might show up.
I enjoyed the first Sherlock Holmes movie that's out with whatever the actor's name is.
I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are they
going to
be
to the second one?
Are they going to be the same actors again?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a reprise.
I just wasn't sure if I was. If he was the right character for it. I forget the actor's name.
Well, you know what it is it's based on the graphic novels, which are much more action oriented.
Right.
And whereas, of course, the Basil Rathbone character.
I'd rather see the guy that's playing House play Sherlock Holmes.
To me,
he could be a great Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
The English actor.
I've gotten tired of him.
Well, he wouldn't be the same guy.
I know.
Wouldn't be the same character.
Yeah. I like the guy. Whatever his name is that we can't think of.
He played with Mel Gibson in Air America,
but
which was a great play.
I think he's cuter than House.
Well, Sherlock Holmes is never about being cute.
I'm sorry. I'm the one that's watching.
Yeah.
I'll have it served my way, thank you.
Yes.
And one watches... One watches these movies for different reasons, yeah. I'm only interested in the damsels in distress, and they seem to be so distressed.
He's got his bottle of aspirin on one side, and he's watching damsels on the other.
Yeah. Yes. So the... So that was one version. And another one that I want to talk about that has literary orientations is a relatively obscure deck. This is one you would not find in bookstores. You'd have to find it online and get it directly from the publisher, Ed Byrne. That's B-U-R-Y-N. And Ed Byrne did a tarot deck about almost 20 years ago. I hate to think it was 20 years ago because I actually remember getting a copy of the original.
Robert Downey Jr., sorry I'm interrupting you.
Yes.
He also played Chaplin and did an amazing job with Charlie Chaplin.
Yes, he did a great job as Charlie Chaplin and a fair job as Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
If you think of Sherlock Holmes in an athletic fashion.
As an action figure.
Yes.
Action figure, yes. Running around doing super somersaults while deducing who the criminal is, and Ed Byrne did this wonderful tarot deck called the Tarot of William Blake.
Ah.
And it's based on a very elaborate, it's based on all William Blake's illustrations, sort of, chopped up to fit iconography. But he based it on the suits instead of being, what they are. He based them on the cosmology, a simplified cosmology. I mean, Blake's writings are very complicated and convoluted, but what he'd managed to do was distill the enough of the actual symbology that's in Blake himself to fit into a tarot deck, and he renamed all the cards and their designations and labeled all of them. He gave them, actually, I think it was 80 cards. He triplexed the fool. In other words, besides just having the zero fool card, he had a double zero fool card.
So this is a book?
There is a booklet that goes with it, which is out of print, but I think is available for free on Ed Byrne's thing, which gives an account.
B-U-R-Y-N.
B-U-R-Y-N, yeah, okay. Byrne, yeah. Ed Byrne, used to be Mr. Mary Kay Greer. They were married, as it was not. Though I don't know. I think Ed's current wife might find that a little. In fact, he might find that a little hard to take. But he was there, and he gave an accounting of his... refurbished deck. There's a new volume. There's a second edition of his deck out, and what he's done is he refurbished the sort of cut and paste things and digitalized them, cleaned them up. You know, there are certain adages or sort of like little koans in each of those, and many of the cards that represent things that are Blake-ish. They aren't necessarily exactly Blake's poetry.
He was certainly an interesting one to pick for that theme because he had a lot of that influence anyway.
Yeah. Well, yes, I mean, that. This is the fact of the matter is it's very simpatico, but it really does show and even though ultimately the tarot is a simple view, you can learn a lot about Blake by learning this tarot deck and reading Blake. In fact,
I just bought the complete works, the complete illustrated Blake. It was expensive, but I've got it.
You got the complete illustrated Blake?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really?
Gorgeous piece of work. It was, like I said, it was very pricey.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, big one.
Yeah.
It was relatively new. Is it a reprint?
I would say, I bought it about, probably 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah. You don't remember who the publisher was? Usually people don't remember. I remember.
I want to say Knopf.
Oh, Knopf. Yeah.
I'm not sure. I think it's Knopf. Yeah. German for button.
Okay.
Yeah. And I usually pronounce it Knopf. Knopf.
Knopf. And now I could be mistaken about that because I do have many books by that publisher, but it just comes to mind.
But you know, Blake's writings are definitely shorter writings, but shorter poems deserve to be read aloud by anyone.
And by the way, when I say illustrated, I mean illustrated with Blake's paintings.
Yes, would hope so. Yeah.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, he did the a lot of his epic poetry was illuminated, and so each page was a illuminated manuscript in a way, not a manuscript, but I think so. He did hand color some of them. Blake was Blake died, singing his own hymns to the angels who had come down to welcome him into heaven, and he was quite a character, and also quite a anarchist. He was an actual socialist anarchist all the way through his life.
I can see that applying.
Strong anti-authoritarian streak in him.
Strong individual is what the way I would say it. Just very strong.
And profoundly, profoundly trusting in his own visionary life. Mm-hmm. Which
we should be talking about William Blake's writings on Carolina Bookbeat sometime.
That would
the next
make a great theme. Yeah.
Right.
Actually,
I should bring the book.
I just threw out
a call to somebody in is he a Duke professor?
No, he's over at Wake Forest University.
Okay.
Speaking of that, very quickly, let's divert for a moment and go, what have you got coming on Carolina Bookbeat?
Well, coming up Monday, we've got Deborah Colleen, who's written a series of fantasy novels for young adults going maybe into older adults.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
they will get there eventually. Yes,
it's a very good series of fantasy novels.
I know on the speakeasy
about five volumes in this in her first series.
Right.
Yeah,
on the speakeasy next week we've got. I just want to mention this because I generally don't mention who's coming on next, but we've got Alex Weiss coming on again, and we're going to talk to him about his trip to the Himalayas. He's getting ready to go and climb a mountain, and then at some point come back and join us in some radio theater, for which we're actually writing the script.
You're going to get him before he goes to the Himalayas.
Yeah.
And we're going to keep up with him while he's doing it and keep people tuned in. And then when he comes back, we'll actually do a radio show together that's going to be radio theater.
Mm-hmm.
The Cosmic Tumblr.
Because how I met the Abominable Snowman.
Yes. Yeti and me.
Yeah.
And he's melting.
Yes, right. So
we've got about 5 minutes or so to wrap this. Usually we give John Paul 5 minutes.
Oh, yes,
let's steer it in that direction.
Yeah, all right.
Out of the fire and into the frying pan and
who
are you in the tarot?
Yeah. So Mary Greer came out with a new book called Who Are You in the Tarot, which is specifically about your personality configurations that are 9 based on the major arcana. And it's nicely done. It's nicely done. One of the things she does explain is the difference between what we could call the Anglo tradition and the continental tradition of Tarot. Sort of like philosophy. There's a difference between analytical and philosophy, versus, which is American, British, and then there is continental philosophy.
And here all this time I thought they meant Thoreau.
Yeah, and yes, and one of the things, the difference in the Tarot is in continental Tarot, the template for what the Tarot is called the Marseille tradition. Marseille tradition is a tradition recognized specifically for divination and so forth. Everybody thinks, you know, goes all the way back to, you know, 17-something rather, which is when the cards became common in Europe. Mainly for playing a game called Tarot, which has nothing to do with the divinational, magical use of the thing. But the Tarot is called the Marseille tradition, and actually goes back for the divinational prices to about 1930. I know everybody would like to wish it went back to the hoary old times of yore, but it didn't. And the same way
How
with...
How disappointing.
With in the we'll call the Anglo tradition, or probably better known as the Golden Dawn tradition, which are two basic tarot styles. One is the Rider-Waite-Smith style, and there are many what are known as clones of the Rider-Waite-Smith. Rider was the publisher, Waite was the author, and Smith. Coleman Smith was the illustrator, and what she's best known for, she was an American who lived most of her life in Britain. It was part of the theater there. Good friends with Ellen Terry and others, and she illustrated all the deck, the full Tarot deck, and she was the first to do this, and her deck has been very well known. The second one was designed during World War II, just before, by Aleister Crowley, and is known as the Thoth deck. That's T-H-O-T-H, which is a beautiful deck, and it was illustrated by Frieda Harris. The variants are both the Thoth and the Rider-Waite-Smith deck represent a... what I would call the Anglo tradition or the Golden Dawn tradition. Marseille, slight variations, don't need to talk about them now.
Not enough time now.
But all told, those are the two basic traditions in Tarot, of which there are lots of sub-variants, which we don't need to get into today. But Tarot is like a never-ending stream of fish in a pond of change.
And here I was going to say consciousness. But it's fish. It's thanks fish. For all the fish.
Yes.
Goodbye and thanks yes. for all the fish.
That's right.
So thank you for having me on. That's and I'm been sure a pleasure. San Francisco may still be there when I come back and talk about it another time.
And even after all that you're talking about it, they might even let you come back.
Yeah, there we go.
And I might even find a hill not flattened yes. by those skyscrapers.
Uh-huh.
Well, you got some music we can put on? I'm going to bring the show to a close at this point. I think we've gone those psychic distances for the time being. And we're going to be back next week with Alex Weiss of Different Drum and talk about his Himalayan trip as well as a radio theater program we're going to start putting on a regular basis.
Oh, yeah. Do you have any idea what kind of radio theater you're
Well, this one I'm writing. It's a piece called Cosmic Tumblr, sort of a... I would say a flavor that crosses between Monty Python and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, something in that early radio spirit.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah,
but we're
we'll
also going to do literature.
Doing, you know, pulling in pieces that we like.
Well, you know, Paradise Lost can give you a...
That'd be a good one. I'm going to pull in some Edgar Allan Poe and anything I can get a hold of. But we're going to try and dedicate 20 minutes of each show coming up to something literary. Anyway, okay. This is Claudio Speakeasy in Radio Theater on WCOM 103.5 FM, my co-host Audrey Layden, and of course we had Paul Nash going the depths with us today. Thanks for listening. Until next time.
Thank you.
Cheers.